And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's now time for All Souls Forum.
Welcome to another All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program is about fish, and it's about the fish you eat and maybe the fish you shouldn't be eating. About half the fish in the U.S. lakes are seriously contaminated with mercury, and of course we've gotten news just recently of a massive die-off of fish around the world, not just in the United States. The program today features Craig Volland, who is the air quality chair for the Kansas Sierra Club. He's been studying this issue since 1990, and we're going to have a comprehensive look at mercury contamination in the food we eat, in this case, mostly seafood. An interesting topic, and I'm sure you'll want to pay attention. This program was recorded on Sunday, May the 18th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. We will have our opening remarks from Rita Norton, and then we'll hear Mr. Volland. And of course, as usual, we'll take our break about 33 or 4 minutes into the program and finish up with the questions and answers from the audience. So let's go to Rita Norton, and we'll start the show off today.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. Craig Volland is one of our rabble-rousers here at All Souls and within the forum committee. He has spent at least 30 years investigating animal abuse of every sort and kind. Even though his professional qualifications are in the electricity field and in the air quality field, which is part of his description for his service to the Sierra Club for several decades as well. This morning he's talking about mercury pollution, and he's got a heck of a lot more to say than I do. Mr. Volland.
Thank you, Rita. The main theme I'm going to talk about today on mercury pollution is really it's parallel to the other major or the major environmental crisis of our time, which is climate change. And climate change is related more than anything else to growth in human population and the industrialization, high levels of consumption. Many of you are familiar with that. I wanted to point out that this is kind of the sidekick to climate change. So I'm going to focus on that mostly and how this came about. Also get into toward the end about the issue that you personally should be most concerned about, which is how this pollution can affect you because it's gotten into the food supply. Mercury is a natural element that's found in the Earth's crust, and significant exposure to the inorganic form, which is called elemental mercury. There are other inorganic forms, but that's the one you're most familiar with. You may have even played with as a child, because back then nobody was really paying any attention. But exposure to it's toxic, but exposure to that is rare. It's mainly occupational exposure. But what we're going to talk about is methyl mercury. Nobody really makes methyl mercury. It's actually made by bacteria in water bodies, primarily by anaerobic bacteria under certain conditions. And it is an extremely toxic developmental neurotoxin. And it is now pervasive in the marine food chain due to industrial pollution. The reason I'm calling it the other industrial or the other global environmental crisis is because such a large percentage of the human race depends on marine food sources. based on the most recent epidemiological studies of people who've been contaminated by mercury from eating marine food sources, methyl mercury has effects that start at 0.2 of a millionth of an ounce per day. That's 0.2 of a millionth of an ounce of methyl mercury per day affects the fetus in the human female. The fetus is the most sensitive receptor. Methyl mercury readily passes through the placenta and the blood-brain barrier and actually concentrates in the fetus. It causes mental retardation and decrements in memory, attention, language, and visual motor skills in childhood. It continues to affect the developing brain, so it also has an effect on growing children. So it really strikes at the heart of our future. Unfortunately, eating fish has also been identified in recent studies as very important for the developing brain. And so the question is, and in fact, the FDA and other agencies have been encouraging women to eat more fish twice a week lately in the last couple of years. So what's a person to do, especially and this is the health paradox. That in itself is a subject that would take a separate forum to get into all the details of the harms and benefits of eating fish, and I will talk about it some toward the end, but I'm going to focus mainly on how we got into this fix through industrial pollution. The main mode of exposure is through consumption of commercially caught marine fish. Most of the fish that we eat in this country is actually imported, the majority of it, which is one of the problems because it's a matter of makes quality control more difficult. But I also want to emphasize that some of the highest mercury exposures can come from eating the top predator fish in our lakes and streams, and I'll get into that a little bit later too. And I won't spend too much time, but there are certain parts of the country where you have a lot of wetlands and acidic waters, and where it's anaerobic conditions will cause even more of the inorganic form of mercury to be changed to the toxic methyl mercury. Fortunately, over the last 20 years, the scientists have developed a way of measuring the exposure that people have to methyl mercury. That's either by testing their blood or their hair. And being able to determine the exposure level by testing of hair is relatively non-invasive and has been a real boon to research in mercury. So if you really wanted to know what your exposure has been, you can have your hair tested. And I think the National Sierra Club for a while was doing that. I haven't checked lately to see if you can still send your hair somewhere. But in the U.S., this problem, which has just gradually grown over the last 100 years or through industrial age, has reached the threshold of harm in our country. Between 8 and 16% of U.S. women living in the U.S. coastal regions, which tend to eat the most fish, have a body burden that's above the impact level. The highest global burden is among Korean women, which is 28%, and that's because, of course, they have a very high diet in marine foods. The good news is the half-life of methylmercury in the blood is 50 to 70 days. That means if you quit being exposed by eating fish, then in 50 to 70 days, your level of in your blood will go down by one half. So there is a way of essentially getting rid of it, or most of it, but it doesn't change the damage that occurs to the developing brain. There's also some evidence that it even affects older folks. So once the damage, once the children and the fetus in particular are exposed to methylmercury, that damage is pretty much permanent. Like I said, I was going to really take the broad view, historical view of mercury pollution. And the term I'll use is anthropogenic, which means caused by humans. And the Anthropocene, and we've actually had a presentation on this here in the forum, I think last year, is that the impact of humans on the Earth's ecology has become so great that the geologists that do these things have proposed that a new geological epoch to acknowledge this massive impact, and it's called the Anthropocene. So that's really what we're talking about here. It's the same as climate change in that respect. The use of mercury goes back several millennia. The Romans, or actually even prior to the Romans, when they started mining gold is when they first discovered that mercury would attach itself to gold and was a way of separating tiny amounts of gold from its environment. And right now, the rate of deposition, meaning coming in the air, is estimated to be 7 times that prior to humans first using it. The current deposition is estimated to be at least 3 times the beginning since the beginning of the industrial age, which is the mid-19th century. So methylmercury is a subtle, long-term anthropogenic pollutant in many ways similar to the principal greenhouse gases, which are carbon dioxide and methane. This worries me just as much as its effects on humans is that a lot of wildlife are now being impacted by the current levels of food chain contamination, to the point that they're beginning to suspect that even the reproduction in the fish themselves is being affected. And for sure, effects have been noted in fish-eating birds like loons, bald eagles and wading birds, and also fish-eating mammals like mink and river otters. And in a recent study a couple years ago, they're even beginning to see effects on songbirds and bats that feed much lower on the food chain. So it's a ubiquitous pollutant. Now the concern for mercury pollution is actually fairly recent. Nobody paid any attention until the Minamata incident in the 1960s. That was Minamata, Japan. There was a chemical company that was disposing of their wastewater into Minamata Bay. And after many years of this, they started noticing people were actually dying and horrifying birth defects in the children. And some of us might still remember that. I do, that it made the headlines in the 1960s. So all of a sudden they started looking at, the regulatory folks started looking at where it might be getting into the streams and water bodies of the United States. So that was where they were focused. Now, I got involved in this issue because about 1989, there was a proposal for a trash incinerator in Kansas City. It was one of 50 proposed trash incinerators around the country. That was going to be the solution to leaking landfills. They were essentially going to replace them with leaking incinerators. And I noticed that one day I was sitting through a presentation about how these were going to be the greatest things in sliced bread, and I noticed that the data showed that they were not removing any of the mercury that was going out to stack. And I said, well, why is nobody paying any attention to that? And so I started asking around, and it turned out the EPA wasn't too concerned because there wasn't wastewater involved. Meanwhile, I read that Swedish scientists had discovered all this methylmercury in their fish and in their fish-eating birds, and they don't have hardly any of these kinds of heavy industry in Sweden, so where was this coming from? So instead of always looking down into streams for this mercury menace, all of a sudden they just looked up and they realized that the vast majority of this mercury was floating in from the air. And just like in the U.S., most of your weather patterns are that they you have a lot of southerly winds, and it was bringing up all this industrial air pollution from mainland Europe and central Europe, and it was getting into their lakes. And so the leading, and still to this day, the leading scientists in this type of metal mercury pollution are the Swedes. And so I noticed there was going to be the first international conference on mercury as a global pollutant in Gävle, Sweden. So I got somebody to sponsor me to go over there. And I was trying to find out, well, how important is it that this stuff is floating around the entire Earth? And so that's how I got involved. It was really as part of trying to assess these trash incinerators they were going to build. Myself and some other folks went around mainly the East Coast, where they were the closest to building, and talked about it. And pretty much they only built about, six or eight of those 150 mass burn incinerators, they called them. And they cleaned up the, or they did a much better job of landfills and preventing leakage. So that's how I became involved. But what was important was we now know that the main source of this mercury pollution is actually from the air, and there's a global mercury cycle. And this is important to the comparison with climate change, because if you look at this graph, and I won't go into too much detail, you'll see there's some natural sources like volcanoes, relatively minor, I'll show you in a minute, but the hatched arrows are re-emissions. I remember when I first got into this, nobody realized that even after the mercury was either deposited directly into a stream or onto the land from air pollution, it actually goes back in the air, and that this is a major component of what's always coming down. So that means that the mercury that, because some forms of mercury, and there's all kinds of chemical reactions that occur in the atmosphere to change the species from one form to another, that this stuff is floating in the atmosphere all over the Earth, and that some of it was deposited originally hundreds of years ago. And that's scary because it just keeps basically dropping and then going back into the air. Elemental mercury, the silvery kind that you're used to, stays in the air. Once it's vaporized, stays in the air up to a year, which means that's plenty of time for it to come to the United States from China, where they're burning a lot of coal now. But I hasten to say they're not the bad guys here, because we did all that 100 years ago. And so a lot of that stuff floated over to China in the last 100 years. So there's no good guys and bad guys in this thing. The other main form to look at is called reactive gaseous mercury. That's typically mercuric chloride, which is highly volatile, and it's formed when you burn anything. When you some of coal burning creates that, depending on how much chlorine's in the coal. But burning, this is why burning trash was so bad, because there's all those PVC plastics and other plastics that are half or a third to one half chlorine, and they created this highly soluble form of mercury called RGM, and it comes, if it's raining the day that it goes out that stack, it'll come right down to the ground because it's so soluble, it's like table salt. So that form of mercury is crucial to local air pollution. For mercury, so that's why some of it comes down from coal plants and cement plants as a major source. So those are the two main forms, but only about 10% of new emissions is from natural sources like volcanoes. Anthropogenic emissions currently are 25%. Biomass burning is 5%. But look at this. Re-emission from the land is 30%, and re-emission from the ocean is 30%. So 60% of the emissions going into the atmosphere are legacy emissions coming from as much as 1,000, 2,000 years ago. So what do we do? There's not a whole lot we can do about the legacy emissions, but the good news is that eventually, given enough time, all of this mercury will be re-sequestered, meaning put back under sediment like it was originally, and will go out of the system. But unfortunately, that's going to take 2,000 years. So what other problem do we have that we talk about? How actually, that's worse than carbon dioxide. I think this cycle, the carbon dioxide lasts 100 years or something like that before it all is cleared out. So even after we stop all the current emissions, we've got a problem for a long time. Not to depress everybody, but it's really very similar to what the real message here, of course, is that it's a similar problem like climate change, and it's going to take a systematic approach to solving it. This is really interesting. When I was studying this years ago, I was fascinated by the way the scientists could go back into history and find out and trace where this mercury came into the system. This is an ice core from Wyoming, and you can see that there's spikes. Like there's the gold rush here in 1850. They put a lot of gold into the atmosphere near Wyoming. It was, of course, mainly California. And so it made a spike there. And then the red there is the industrialization of America, where it became more systematic pollution. But those other blue spikes are actually volcano eruptions. They also put cores down into the bottom of lakes and also show a similar pattern. Now, this is only in the industrial age. There's other I've seen other cores, lake cores, that show even the effect from the Romans and Greeks when they were mining silver and gold. So what are all of the most current emissions? Is burning coal is one of them. Metals mining production, cement. This is a little known fact cement manufacturing uses limestone. They basically bake limestone to get rid of the CO2 and make lime. Well, they also get rid of the mercury because that used to be the bottom of the ocean and there was mercury there. So actually limestone has mercury, plus some of these cement kilns are being used to burn hazardous waste, and there's a loophole there where they're not actually removing it. Another story. That's the main sources of industrial activity. Then there's product use, where if you burn the waste, if it all goes into a burner, and there are some garbage burners still operating, I'm pleased to say that we did manage to get carbon removal devices on these. Carbon will remove mercury vapor, but not in other countries necessarily. Then one of the big problems is artisanal gold, which is small-scale gold mining, which is going on in the poorer parts of Central South America and in Africa. And that is a major problem I'll talk about a little bit more later. Then there's cremation, which is relatively minor, but all that mercury in our teeth goes back into the air, unfortunately. Now, this is the current hot spots of the current emission of mercury. And you can see, if you've ever looked at the hot spots for carbon dioxide emission, they're almost identical. India and China are just pouring out carbon dioxide right now and methane to a certain extent. And so now they're building lots of coal plants, and they're not taking the mercury out. Europe, you can see, is still somewhat of a hot spot, although less than it used to be. And then you can spot the artisanal gold mining in South America and in Africa. So it's very much similar to climate change. 100 million people depend on artisanal gold mining, primarily in these developing countries. And with over 2,000 coal-fired power plants, China accounts for 40% of the total emissions. But, like I said earlier, much of the legacy the emissions that are being re-emitted came from U.S. and Europe and our gold mining and our burning of coal and trash. U.S., China, and India account for 60%. So it's very much related to industrial growth. The recent research has detected a decline in the ambient, meaning floating around, contamination levels in the North Atlantic region, which tracks the decline in emissions from Europe and the U.S. because we have begun to control them, but they're still growing rapidly in Asia. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the personal health risks from eating fish. This has been pretty much the standard advisory, methylmercury in seafood. The threshold is essentially 220 parts per billion or 0.22 parts per million, where you should eat no more than one meal per month over that, and over 0.95 parts per million or 950 parts per billion, there should be no consumption. And things like marlin, don't eat marlin and swordfish. It's just loaded. So I'll get into that a little bit more. But lately, due to a lot of research showing the benefits to the developing brain of fetus and child, the FDA and others started urging pregnant women to eat two meals per week, and I'll talk about how that's fairly risky. These shows that there's a wide range in mercury content in the types of fish. The 0.2 there is near the that shaded area is the threshold of harm, the current threshold of harm. Interestingly, that threshold of 230 parts per billion was determined in 2001, and the EPA took the known science at that time and applied a 10 times safety factor to the consumption level and came up with that 230 parts per billion. But in the last 5 years, several studies have indicated that there is subtle effects on children and fetuses at this level, meaning there is no safety factor. That there's even some scientists say that the threshold that is currently in place for that previous advisory I just showed you, there is no safety factor in that anymore. Now this is an attempt here to, you're all saying, well, what do I do about eating fish? Well, it's pretty complicated. If you look along the top of that chart, going to your right, you'll see that that's the increasing omega-3. Now, what's good in fish is the types of omega-3 fatty acids that helps with brain development. And so you go that direction to get more out of the fish, but to go down the chart is where there's more and more mercury. And so this is an attempt, this was from the Biodiversity Research Institute. And you can go on their website and get that report. But it shows you basically the calculation you're supposed to make before you eat fish. Unfortunately, the advisories from the regulatory agencies are also out of date. The Environmental Defense Fund, in connection with Stony Brook University in New York, compared the FDA database for fish with a much bigger database and found that even some of the low mercury fish that they were recommending were underestimated by the FDA in terms of mercury. And the little triangles there are the differences in types of fish, and And a lot of the low mercury ones were underestimated. They're still fairly low in mercury, but not as safe as one thinks. So there's now a big battle going on between the regulatory agencies that want people to eat more fish and the environmental groups, and I think the EPA is somewhere in the middle, that are concerned about the mercury impacts. Now, this is from the Environmental Working Group, which is really interesting. They took this latest data and showed that the good choices are listed on the left, one of which is salmon, and I would recommend wild salmon because farm salmon has problems of its own depending on what's coming in the food supply. And those, there seems to be some agreement. That the other underlying problem here is that we're stripping the oceans. We essentially have been strip mining the oceans for decades. So as soon as I tell everybody to go eat wild salmon, in 5 years or so, there won't be any. Or there will be, because we're that short anymore in fish stocks. So it's quite a dilemma. Interestingly, the second column there are fish that are low in mercury, but they're also low in omega-3s. So you can eat all the tilapia you want, which is a farm fish. It's fish. But it has nothing in it particularly, as far as omega-3s are concerned, that's going to solve the problem. Now, it's still a good fish to eat, I mean, from the standpoint of protein and so on, I presume. But it is not the solution to the problem. And then it goes to show based on two meals a week, the recommendation of some of the regulatory agencies, and the seafood industry, show that, in fact, those fish that they say are safe are, in fact, not safe at that level of consumption. So it's a real dilemma, and I wish I had more time to go into that, and we can talk about it more in the meeting room. Another really serious problem is that you have remote populations like the Inuit that eat a lot of way of marine mammals that are very high in methylmercury. When I was looking at this some time ago, it occurred to me, how is it that porpoises and seals and whales can get by with such high body burdens? And it occurred to me, they've been living with this for millions of years, which is to say, they basically evolved defenses against methylmercury in their food supply. However, it's getting high enough that there's some feel that there's some impact on their ability to reproduce. But if you're an Inuit eating this stuff, you're in real trouble. There's been some studies of their impacts. Now, to get to quickly to the freshwater fish, which I kind of got back involved because I've been haunting the Kansas Department of Health and Environments on some pollution, local pollution issues, and got a look at their record of all the tests of mercury they do on fish in Kansas. And it turns out that there's a real problem in Kansas even, which is not that heavily industrial state. But the EPA did some studies a few years ago that showed that the 50 percentile value in predator fish, mainly walleye and bass, is 285 parts per billion, which exceeds the threshold of harm of 230. So I personally wouldn't eat any bass anywhere in this country. You could maybe eat one or two meals every couple months and get away with it. The freshwater, our freshwater lakes in America are heavily polluted by mercury. Now, notice that the 50 percentile value in bottom-dwelling fish is only 69 parts per billion, so it's still safe to eat probably one meal a week for catfish, for example. In fact, that's about the only fish that I eat. Maybe it's because I grew up in the South. The new, just this last year, the state of Kansas up their advisory for women of childbearing age and children under 12 from one meal per week to one meal per month. Because what happened was they changed the method they were using to measure mercury in fish, and were finding alarmingly high levels in some bass, as much as 600, 700 parts per billion in the eastern half of the state. When you get in the western half, it's not as bad. The Missouri advisory is about the same. This is one of the reasons why, even though Kansas is not so much an industrial state, we do have a problem. There are a lot of monitors out there measuring wet deposition, and you can see this was 2009, a heavy rain year. It is related to rainfall, where eastern Kansas was as bad as anywhere else in the southeast as far as wet deposition of mercury, meaning in rainfall. That was the next year, which was a dry year, and then here again is 2011, which was a relatively dry year. But if you look at this data going back 10 years, you can see that we're getting a big dose both in Missouri and Kansas. Current prospects for action on doing this. Fortunately, the Supreme Court in just the last 2 weeks confirmed the EPA's new rules that require coal-fired power plants to radically reduce their mercury pollution. That was a big win for the environment. That has to be done by 2016. That will result most likely in the shutdown of most of these old 40- and 50-year-old coal plants, which will also have a big effect on greenhouse gas emissions. Europe, of course, took action 20 years ago, mainly at the behest of the Swedes and other scientists there. So progress has been made in current emissions. And it's widely recognized that we need cooperation with the developing Asian countries to beat this problem or at least get a handle on it. So last year, 140 nations agreed to the Minamata Convention, which is supposed to reduce emissions from coal plants, gold mines, and some factories by the year 2020. Does this sound familiar? These are the meetings that are constantly being held on climate change, and of course then there's does it really work? I don't know. That's why I'm giving this presentation, so more people know about this. Now, this is the final point, is that millions and millions of years ago, when the Earth was warmer, a lot of this mercury was floating around the atmosphere. Well, it got sequestered by being breathed in by plants, and in some cases it attached to sulfur and became cinnabar ore, and essentially over millions of years became sequestered and out of the system. So what do? We dig it all back up and put it back into the atmosphere in the space of mostly 200 years. But humans did not, unlike the whales and the dolphins and the seals, humans did not evolve with methylmercury. So we didn't evolve defenses, and that is why it is such a sensitive, extremely toxic neurotoxin to humans, and it attacks us at the most vulnerable point, which is our young. That's also very similar to the greenhouse gas problem. We dug up all those old plants. That's what coal is, you know, it's just old plants, and throw in a few swamp creatures, and you put it all back in the atmosphere. So it's essentially the sidekick to climate change, and it's going to require some of the same kinds of solutions. So thank you.
You've been listening to Craig Vollen talk about mercury contamination in seafood, in the food that we eat. We're going to take a short break. We owe you some messages. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Thanks for tuning in. You can also find us via podcast on the KKFI website. If you miss part of the show or you want to share it with someone, you can go to www.kkfi.org and find our podcast list on the front page and click on it, and it's easy to search, and you can find the All Souls programs that we have uploaded there for your use. So let's take a break. We'll be right back with the rest of the program today.
Support for KKFI provided by Here Now, the Audio Fiction and Arts Festival. The Here Now Festival brings to Kansas City award-winning audiobook narrators and audio performers from Thursday, June 19th through Saturday, June 21st with live performances daily by Golden Voice narrators Simon Vance, Barbara Rosenblatt, Scott Brick, Robin Miles, and many others. All access passes, workshop registration, and program details available at herenowfestival.org.
And there it was. After 3.5 days of legal haggling, Ralston had set the exact limits on the case that the prosecution wanted. But the defense was determined to keep the broader issues in play. Stewart estimated that his whole case would take only an hour, while the defense believed their case would take weeks. Scopes then pleaded,
not guilty.
The great Tennessee Monkey Trial on LA Theater Works, Wednesday evening at 7.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On Saturday, June 14th at IBEW Local 124, the Heartland Labor Forum will celebrate 25 years of talking back to the boss with two of our favorite Hellraisers, America's number one populist Jim Hightower and labor troubadour Ann Feeney. We'll have a VIP meet and greet dinner at 6 p.m., followed by a hell-raising speech in concert at 7. Details, advance tickets, and directions are available at kkfi.org. We do the
work. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll talk to Alexandra Bradbury of Labor Notes about her new book, How to Jumpstart Your Union, on the Chicago Teachers Strike, one of the most successful strikes in modern U.S. history. Then, the United Auto Workers will face the Big Three in negotiations this fall. Can they eliminate two-tier wages? What happened at the bargaining convention with the dues increase to build the strike fund? We'll talk to a delegate. All this Thursday at 6 p.m. rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
It was a culture that at its root was a we culture. How do we undo the homeless culture and come home where it's we again?
I'm Neil Harvey. It's Betting Big on a Dream, Coming Home to a We Culture with Tribal Chairman Greg Saris on The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Hey, I'm Casey Roush.
And this is Mikhail Shapiro.
Join us Sunday mornings 9 to 11 for River Trade Radio, our new folk show,
featuring local and touring songwriters with elements of Americana, roots, bluegrass, country, and more,
where musical trade routes meet. River Trade Radio, Sundays 9 to 11 a.m. Tune in to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio,
or stream live at kkfi.org.
Hi, this is Mark Manning. For local and new releases in a mix of all genres, for interviews with artists, musicians, and writers, for freeform radio that plays with themes, questions, and events, tune in to Wednesday Midday Medley, Wednesdays from 10 to noon, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
A question about farm-raised fish compared to wild. You noted wild salmon was better. And you also noted that catfish was the only fish you eat. But catfish, I've heard, farm-raised has problems. So what is the problem there, and what do you recommend?
Well, I am okay with catfish, mainly because I eat it at a restaurant whose proprietor, that she is going to get it from a reputable source. There is a problem with farmed fish, both farm catfish, because there's other sources of pollution besides mercury that can get into these in many cases artificial ponds they make to put catfish in. They're basically wallowing around in shallow bottoms, so if there's if they're spraying pesticides or anything else near that area, then it can also get in there. So there is somewhat of a risk, but it's a risk, it's a dose response issue, so you have to kind of figure out what kind of risk you're going to take. I think it's relatively minor with a reputable source of catfish. And that's, and also because they're bottom feeders. That means they will pick up some mercury, but it's at the, you know, the tiny animals at the bottom of the food chain instead of, they don't eat fish that have higher levels in them. Salmon, I think the farmed salmon is also low in mercury, but there's issues about the quality of the feed that they're given these salmon in these huge pens, that whether that's, there's been some, I think, measurements of other toxics. But here again, I haven't studied that in great detail. I'm basically repeating what I've heard by other knowledgeable people, that wild salmon for sure is cleaner. But salmon as a whole, to my knowledge, has, whether it's farmed or wild, still has a good omega-3s in it. So actually what I would suggest is I would do some research on your own. If you want to eat fish, is to go to the Biodiversity Research Institute, go to the Environmental Defense Fund and the Environmental Working Group, and they have some of their own advice on what fish to eat.
Craig, my doctor has recommended that I take fish oil tablets, so I do. Is that a, do you know anything about that? The capsules of fish oil?
I think some of this fish oil they're getting from krill now is what I've read. I'm not an expert on that. That concerns me because they're now going into the South Pacific and harvesting all this krill. Well, krill is the beginning of the food chain for almost everything in the oceans. So here's another form of strip mining. So my concerns with fish oil is I think it's probably healthy, but what kind of environmental impacts are we having? But that's a personal decision. I would not take a lot of it, but if it were me, I don't bother with it. But if your doctor tells you to do it, who am I to contradict that?
As you were talking, I thought about autism. Seems to me that would be a logical cause of it.
Well, some of these recent, I don't know about autism per se, and there's probably people out there that know more about it than I do, but the attention deficit, the ADHD, has been linked to mercury pollution. And just the last 3 or 4 years, that has been identified as an apparent impact of mercury contamination on young children and especially the fetus. Keep in mind, it's the fetus that is the most sensitive receptor because it actually, if the mother has 20 micrograms in her body, the fetus will have 40. It basically, the numbers roughly double in the fetus. And why that is, I don't know, but that's pretty scary. So, but there is a problem with the ADHD, which I don't think is the same as autism. Somebody out there might know, but it's a serious problem. And there seems to be a growing problem. But have they made a definitive connection to mercury? No. There's probably other. As a matter of fact, I know from other research that PCBs have definitely been connected to, it's another really potent neurotoxin, that they're no longer manufacturing, but they used to manufacture in large amounts, and it never goes away once it gets in the environment. And so it has been connected to that.
Greg, you've been in the movement business for a long time. and it occurs to me, as you were talking, that this is another example of where our capacity to invent far outstrips our capacity to collaborate. And so I find myself wondering here and other places, mightn't it be better at this point for folks like us to focus on almost entirely on attacking the collaboration challenge? I'm aware of a recent meeting in Brazil on future of the Internet and the World Wide Web and something called multi-stakeholderism, which is an ugly version for meet, talk, and power gets what it wants in the end. Haven't we been let down by how much we think we can accomplish with science alone and reason?
Oh, I think that's absolutely, that's the great question of our time, is humans have evolved this absolutely incredible brain power, but our social skills are probably thousands of years old, and we have not really advanced our social skills to get along. In fact, in some people would say we've had more warfare and lack of cooperation. I think that's exactly it. Part of this issue here with Mercury. Nobody cared when the U.S. and Europe was developing very rapidly and putting all this stuff in the air that's still in the air, the Mercury. And so now our tendency is to blame the Chinese and the people of India, because they're now going through the same cycle we did. So we want to go and have a conference and have them do something. And I think there's some basis for saying, well, maybe we should contribute to them solving these problems. But instead, these meetings break down because the politics in America, particularly, it's the economy, stupid. And that was one, we all know when that was stated with Bill Clinton in his campaign. It's still the case that that's what most of us look at. How are my stocks doing and my investments? And we've got to change that to become a global community that addresses these things together. And I guess the UN is, in fact, the UN is actually very active in this issue. They're the ones that brokered the Minamata Convention. But does that mean that the countries will actually abide by these? That's another issue. But we're getting kind of late in the game where we really do need to do something. But the underlying crisis to it all, in my opinion, is population growth. How do you tell people that have never had anything to consume less? That's even a bigger crisis that we face, and I don't know the answer to that one. Not to depress everybody.
One of my education issues is related to helping more and more people truly understand that we live on a globe. And when you related climate change to the mercury problem, you spent a couple of minutes talking about how those are similar. Would you reiterate and develop a little bit?
Well, the last thing I said was that it's really related to the, I think we're up to 7 billion people now. And we have a cultural desire, of course, for a better life, which is unfortunately interpreted by most people as getting more things, consuming more. And so the ultimate problem is that we have 7 billion people that are now approaching the carrying capacity of the Earth. I actually have a great deal of faith in what humans have done best, which is to adapt. We have adapted in the shorter term with technology. For example, solar panel, the cost of solar panels has come down greatly. And so in California, people are just putting them up all over the place because they have very good insulation there. In Kansas, we put in a record amount of wind turbines in the last couple of years for the state of Kansas. So we are capable of adapting. This is kind of a form of adaptation that is much faster than evolutionary adaptation. That's what technology really is. So the Internet is another way of reducing. I'm actually positive on the Internet because people in Africa can see, or education information can be conveyed to them a lot more efficiently than in the past. So there are bright spots. I guess the question is, it's a race. Who's going to win? Are we going to fall apart before we develop these adaptations? I guess it's just by nature, believe it or not, after that talk, I'm actually fairly optimistic about our ability and willingness. Maybe it's because I inhabit places like this where we generally do take the point of view that we can overcome some of these problems. That's where we are. We're basically at the threshold of harm on climate change. We're at the threshold of harm on mercury pollution and other things. The one thing that worries me the most about mercury is that it attacks the fetus. And if you really think about it, if our intellectual capabilities are compromised, that compromises the way we can adapt in the short term. So
it seems that almost all our food supply has a number of pollutants and things that are dangerous to us. You've talked about fish. I don't ever eat fish. I don't like it. So that's not an issue. I don't eat much meat. But, I mean, you've shown things about poultry, hogs, et cetera. So what is probably the safest diet to have? And do we need to start growing our own and buy locally organic? Or what would you recommend?
Oh, I love that question. I'm sure that's not an accident. Because the other thing I work on the most, I'm the most passionate about, is the food system. And for example, I forgot to mention that I get most of my omega-3 by ground flaxseed. Flaxseed is, of all the plants, has the most omega-3. It's not in the best form, but your body actually transforms it to the brain food. So that's one thing. I am not a vegetarian, but we have to vastly reduce the amount of meat we are eating for all kinds of reasons. The industrial meat is contaminated. It's almost all contaminated. There's study after study. Sure, that's why you almost have to dress up in a biohazard suit to cook it in your kitchen. And they're always telling you, wash this, wash that. Well, you know, I don't need to tell you how that meat is produced these days. I also have to say that our regulatory agencies are pretty much asleep on the switch, at the switch on that with the antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which has not been resolved yet. They're finally starting to do something about it. So I think a diet that is relatively low on the food chain is the way to go, and grow a lot of your own, or buy it from local farmers. And as you know, Kansas City actually has a lot of opportunity now for getting your food locally. And it's primarily plant-based, but there's also really reputable farmers doing free-range meats as well. So that's what I do, is a little bit of meat, but a lot of veggies, and I'm still kicking.
You've been listening to All Souls Church member Craig Volland, who is also the air quality chair for the Kansas Sierra Club. He's been talking about how fish in U.S. lakes are seriously contaminated with mercury and why we probably should steer clear of a lot of them, if not all of them. Today's program was recorded on Sunday, May 18th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help with the production of this program each week. And also thank you to Fred Potter, who has written and performed the All Souls theme song that you hear now every week on this program. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's Community Radio.